How are y'all doing tonight? My name is Scott Harmon. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm going to take a moment here to get this one right. All right. Get this right. All right, good enough. All right. My sobriety date is April 1st, April Fool's Day, 1987. My home group is the Common Solution Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Durham, North Carolina. We meet on Monday nights. It is a queer meeting. We meet at 6:30. My home group in Crystal Meth Anonymous is the De-Icers group. We meet on Tuesday nights in downtown Durham at 7 p.m. I am gratitude, the theme of your conference this weekend. One of my dear old mentors who's moved on to the great meeting in the sky told me one day, he said, Scott, gratitude is the only gift you can give your higher power that he doesn't already have. And to this day, it is one of the most mysterious forces in these rooms when there's no surefire way for me to get out of myself, get out of my way, and to be excited about the gifts that I've been given in a humble way rather than an arrogant way, which is what like would have happened, you know, in the past, like 3 days ago. I also want to thank Stephen and Karen for leading a magnificent roundup this year. I think you deserve. I want to thank Agatha and Barry, the program chairs, for the great workshops and for inviting me to speak. I want to thank Dave, one of their spies, who went to Miami earlier this year and brought my tape back, which is why I'm here today. Y'all have, your hospitality is amazing. And, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line, we don't believe that people from up north have hospitality. So I've been warmly impressed. Y'all have been very generous and very warm, and I've made so many friends, both David, we call him Nugget, that's his nickname. He might not tell you that. He's one of our favorite vacations we ever took was in Canada about 5 years ago, and we started in Toronto, and we took a train trip across the entire country all the way to Banff, and then got on the Rocky Mountaineer and took it down. It was so beautiful. And like, you know, the first part of that train trip was like 3 days of pine trees and 3 days of canola flowers. So I felt very small, which is great for an alcoholic. You know, it's a good spiritual practice there. But it's such a beautiful country, and you're very proud of it, and you have every right to be. And I think you're an amazing, amazing nation, and there's a lot of things that our country, our adolescent country, could learn from you. So anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. I like to start out my story. In 2005, my mother was dealing with cancer, and I took her to Duke University in Durham to have an MRI, a special scan done. And this is usually an all-day affair, trying to get her in and out of there, and we go up to the very early in the morning to the woman sitting behind the counter, and she's typing on the computer. She has these butterfly glasses and looking very serious, and she looks up, and my mother's last name is Cooper, and she said, Miss Cooper, she said, did you take your contrast this morning? And, you know, that horrible milkshake you have to drink before you do an MRI. And my mom said, yes, but I had to put some gin in it. And I was like, oh, shit, mother, you have pissed off the church lady. Because this woman kind of looked up like over the top of her glasses. She's typing away, looking at my mother with this very serious, piercing look. And she said, Miss Cooper, she said, that'll ruin some gin. I thought we were going to be there all day. We were out in an hour. It was done. So, my mom was a good alcoholic. I learned all of my best qualities I get from her. She was driven. She was controlling. She knew how to get her way. And I worshiped the ground she worked on, that she walked on. I remember this one day when I was about, 14, we pulled into this shopping mall, it was just her and I. She pulls into the parking spot, and this guy pulls in right next to us and opens up his door and just kind of, you know, barely hits the side of her car with the door. It wasn't bad, but he kind of turned and then realized there was someone in the car, and so he turned away trying to pretend like he didn't see us, but she and I knew that he saw us in there. So he gets in, goes up to the mall, like, doesn't say a word, tries to pretend like he didn't even see us there. So my mother gets out and keys the side of his car right there in front of me. No shame whatsoever. These are the lessons that I learned from my mother. She never had a chance to work a fourth step, but it would have been a long one, I assure you. So I was born in 1962 in Atlanta, Georgia. My first recollection of substance abuse is paregoric. I don't even know if you can still get it. It's this licorice anise tasting substance. It's basically liquid heroin. And I remember this dual conversation going on in my brain as like a four-year-old. Like my stomach hurts and I'm in this terrible pain and I can't stand it. But this other voice in my head said, yes, but you're going to get some of that good stuff. And when you drink it, it's going to make you feel completely okay. And that, you know, would have, looking back now, is my first clue that I have what I understand as a soul sickness. Lila R. from Santa Monica, California, shared at a roundup I was at recently, best story I've ever heard, 42 years sober, lesbian, very powerful woman. And she said, it's a soul sickness called alcoholism, and I have it. And I believe that I was born with it. I was a child of the sexual revolution. I grew up, I was a very awkward child. I remember that same feeling of not fitting in, and you know, this is still a thought that can come into my brain even today. We were sharing in a number of the workshops today about every time that idea in my head comes out that, you know, I don't belong, or I'm not young enough, or rich enough, or, you know, gay enough. Well, I don't know if anyone would accuse me of that, but you know, that feeling of not belonging is always rooted in my disease of alcoholism, but it masks itself as some other thing that I think is keeping me apart from you. But that feeling of not belonging started very young, long before I started abusing alcohol and drugs. Somewhere around 15 years old, pardon me, women, but this little magic combination of dick, disco, and drugs kicked in within about 1 6-month period. And it was a very powerful combination for me. I discovered myself sexually. I came out. I discovered Donna Summer. I it was the 70s. And I started first with beer and then other substances and then marijuana, which is definitely a gateway drug to all kinds of other things. My mom was right. And suddenly I fit in, and I was wanted, I was desired, I was, I had arrived. I felt, you know, I remember that the first time I got drunk on Passport Scotch, I told myself I was a Scotch drinker because I had somehow pictured that Scotch drinkers are more sophisticated than other drinkers. And I hated the taste of this stuff, but oh my God, it's like I could drink about a half a bottle of it, and this warm, glowing fire would just start burning down here in my belly, and all the things that I had worried about would like suddenly go away. It was like the difference between a haunted house with like cobwebs and dust and, you know, monsters hiding in the dark, and then I would take this drink, and then all of a sudden it was like this warm fire, and the families around the table having Thanksgiving, and the angels are singing, and... You know, it's like everything is okay, and it was just this magic liquid would do this to me. You know, I know that normal people can drink or take drugs and sort of do stupid things, but eventually the consequences of this behavior is going to tell them to stop, and they're like, you know, it messes up my life. I'm not going to do it again. But not me. That feeling of well-being that it gave me was so powerful. As it says in the book, I was willing to chase it to the gates of death. And I'm very grateful I didn't have to go quite that far, although I got pretty close. So went to school, went to college, studied architecture in Houston. Quickly, when I was 11, we moved to Houston, and I lived there for about 20 years and then moved to Durham, North Carolina, where I live now. Always did really well in school. I was the sort of A-type child. You know, I learned very early on that if I did well in school and studied hard and made good grades, that I could get away with anything else I wanted to do. So, you know, my pattern was make the outside look really good and then hide all the weird stuff inside, not just the things I was doing that I knew I would get in trouble for if I were caught, but also the things that I was feeling about myself that I couldn't reconcile or understand. And so, and just over the years, just spending more and more energy keeping that facade. And I'm amazed at how, like we can be crashing down to the bottom and we're still like holding up this facade. I'm amazed, like when I got close to going into treatment, how few people knew like how bad I really was. So I had started selling drugs. I was a chair of this fundraising ball at school. I was embezzling money. You know, I watch, my story includes other substances besides alcohol, and I'm grateful that I was encouraged to, you know, share that from the podium tonight. I won't dwell on it. It is an AA conference. But, you know, I am grateful because, you know, the trajectory of a typical alcoholic is a very long, slow, and painful demise that can last decades. And that was the course that I was on. You know, my mother passed away at 70 years old, never having gotten sober. And the prospect of living that long in the path that I was on is really very frightening. But as soon as I started interjecting other substances, and it primarily ended up being cocaine, that path just started taking a serious nosedive. And so I'm stealing money to pay for my habit. I'm hiding alcohol in my parents' bedroom. I'm in my bedroom from my parents because I was no longer drinking in an amount that would let me sort of take from their bar, because even though they drank a lot, I knew I was drinking too much, and I had to sort of have my own stash. And twice I remember almost overdosing, where it was laying on the floor. I could not get up because my heart was pounding so hard that it was getting ready to come out of my chest. And I remember both occasions being so afraid that my parents would come home from the lake house after the weekend and find me laying dead on my bedroom floor. It was March of 1987. I was in my last year of college, and the previous semester I had made nothing less than a B on my transcript. And that semester I had dropped out of every course but one, and I was failing that one, and it was painting. I was failing painting. I'm a gay man, and I was failing painting. The shame. And no one knew. No one knew. My parents did not know that I was not going to graduate come May. And I reached out to a psychiatrist. I'd been to a couple of psychiatrists before over the years and had very good experiences with them, thankfully, and I knew something was wrong. I was convinced it was school and the stress of the world. As any good alcoholic, I was convinced that that was the problem, and that if you had that you'd do the same things that I was doing. You'd make the same decisions that I was making. And I remember talking on the phone to this psychiatrist one day, and I was like, yeah, it's like, man, school's really hard, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And then it's just like, oh, cocaine problem. He's like, what was that part again? And so, you know, long story short, they recommended I go into treatment. I thought that was harsh, but I was willing to do it because, frankly, because what I realized eventually was that if I went into treatment, I would be able to get a medical withdrawal from school and save I'd be able to save that facade that I worked so hard to keep up. So, you know, these rooms are full of people who, and I'm a perfect example of someone who comes in for all the wrong reasons. And it's fine. That's as good enough a reason to get in here as any. It doesn't really matter how we get in here. I'm one of those people who did not realize I wanted recovery until I got to recovery. And I got here, like I said, walked in for all the wrong reasons, but I'm very grateful that I did. I'm very fortunate, you know, I remember my mom taking me to the treatment center. It was March 28th, 29th, something like that. I just rounded up to April 1st. Once someone told me I had to have a sobriety date, I knew I'd never remember a date like that. So I just rounded up to April Fool's Day. It was just easier. So April 1st is what I celebrate as my sobriety date. But I remember when Mom dropped me off at the mental institution, which is what it was, and she got up to leave, and you know, the doors were locked, and she could leave, and I couldn't. And she was crying. And it dawned on me that the last time that that had happened was when she dropped me off at kindergarten. And I like to think that this is kind of what I had become. And I don't ever want to forget what it was like to watch that pain in her when she dropped me off. And it was that combination of terror and gratitude that maybe I was going to be safe. Some of us relapse before we come in the rooms, and some of us relapse after we come in the rooms. But no one walks through those doors and into the seats that you're sitting in here having tried to quit and found out that you couldn't. So when people like to think that their relapses are keeping them, or that the quality of their sobriety is somehow less than the quality of those who end up only getting one chip, I always remember that, because it's really the same. There's really no difference. I just tell people, just get back in the life raft and help us row. That's all we care about. Just put your hand on an oar and row. We got work to do, and we need your help. And if you start misbehaving, I'll grab the oar and I'll whack you upside the head with it. Just so you feel like you're at home, you know. And then I'll hand it back to you, and you keep rowing. So I got sober in Houston, Texas, at the Lambda Center there, the great gay AA club. And I loved it because it was just like the gay world that I had experienced, but with drugs and alcohol. Y'all were like sleeping with each other. You had all this like bitchy drama going on. And I was like, I was at home. I was like, I can do this. That's like, you know, I very quickly figured out that my life sober was not going to be boring. I was very grateful for this. I had a sponsor that was assigned to me while I was in treatment, and we started working the steps while I was in treatment, and I got all the way through six or seven, and we did a fifth step, and then we kind of got to six, and the momentum just sort of wore off. I lost my momentum, and he lost his, and we just stopped working the steps. And then after a year and a half of my sobriety, he got drunk. And I was really devastated by that because, it was very difficult. I didn't realize how difficult it was, but 5 years later, I'm still looking for that perfect sponsor, wondering like how I could possibly find someone who I could relate to. And again, that whole idea of like, I've got to find like the perfect, you know, things, that unwillingness to take the smallest first step towards a solution, because I cannot predict with absolute certainty where and how I'm going to end up. This is as good a definition of alcoholism as I know. just frozen in fear, unwilling to take one step for lack of control. I got into a relationship in early sobriety. Actually, just to be honest, like our anniversary date was like the same day as my sobriety date, like same year and everything. yeah. I didn't even make it to the rooms like in time for y'all to tell me like, don't get in a relationship. Like I'd already made that mistake. This was someone I knew outside of that I'd known before I got into recovery, and who was very helpful in getting me to recovery. And we were a match made in heaven. I mean, he was looking for a project, I was looking for a safe harbor. It was perfect. It was a relationship that should have ended after 1 year, and it took me 9 more years in order to get out of that relationship. It was, I'm not going to dwell on it tonight, but there was a lot of, he was probably borderline sociopathic, psychopathic. He was involved in some cult stuff, and he had woven a lot of stories around our relationship and around my recovery that had convinced me that there's a lot of emotional blackmail involved there. And it's a little uncomfortable to talk about today because I sort of know how battered spouses feel, although there was thankfully never any physical abuse in this relationship. But after about 5 years, I started suspecting that something was not true in the stories that he was telling me. And what that meant was that I had allowed this to go on for so long. And what would that say about me, that I had allowed that to happen? Because that was certainly not what I had envisioned about myself. So any idea about that got swept under the rug, and I kept going. And it took another 5 years for me to get out of that relationship. We did a geographic cure back to the Southeast. I think both he and I felt like we were going to, that was going to fix us. And I remember Let me back up. July 1987, 2 months, 3 months after I'd gotten sober, I went and had an HIV test and was not surprised with the results because about 6 months before I had hit my bottom, I had stopped doing the simple things that I knew were keeping me safe. When I tell my story in straight meetings, it's not as important a fact to make today because, frankly, this disease is a lot more common and chronic today than it was at the time. But I made a point of always saying I'm HIV positive not because I'm gay, but because I'm an alcoholic. I knew how to protect myself, and I had just stopped caring and started allowing things to happen. And I was not surprised with the results. I remember what the nurse looked like. I remember sitting in this little curtained cubicle when she gave me the results, and I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, when I heard it, this idea kind of popped into my brain. It was like, all right, Scott, here's what you're going to do. You're not going to ignore this, but you're going to pretend and act as if you have every expectation of a normal lifespan. That's how you're going to manage this. And because I'd had a lot of friends who had found out that they were HIV positive at the time and had started like running up all this credit card debt, and that idea about like, you know, I'm going to die anyway, so what the hell? And there was something that told me that that was not going to work for me, that I would, number one, I would not be able to stay sober if I had that attitude. And number two, I knew that I would like run up $150,000 worth of credit card debt and then they'd find a cure and I'd spend the rest of my miserable life paying it back. So, and you know, I was 20 years sober before it dawned on me that that was not a thought that I was capable of. I was 3 months sober. I was in my 20s. I was a mess. I was a hot little mess. That kind of judgment, that kind of wisdom is not possible in the mind of someone like that. And it dawned on me finally after 20 years that this was my higher power. And this says so much to me about my higher power, that my higher power can take an idea, quietly plant it in my brain, and then run hide. Because I had such a chip on my shoulder about the idea about God, I could not accept the idea that there was anything greater than me that would actually be able to help me or guide me through my sobriety. And that's how great a higher power has to be, I think, in order to get us sober, that it can put an idea in our head and let us think for 20 years that it was our idea. one of the marks of the hand of God in my life is when something happens that I could not have designed myself. And I see that evidence everywhere and all the time now. About 7 years sober, living in North Carolina, that horrible relationship is still not working very well. And I'm going to meetings, I'm doing all the things I'm supposed to be doing. But, you know, remember that part I told you about that I kind of got up to like six and then kind of stopped? So, you know, half measures availed us nothing. And I was sitting with nothing at that point in time. And I'd started having a lot of secrets that I wasn't sharing with people. I wasn't feeling connected. I was going to meetings every day, and I still wasn't feeling connected. I was trapped in this relationship that I couldn't talk about because I was afraid of what would happen to me. And I knew that I was either going to drink or I was going to put a bullet through my brain. And I reached out to a friend of mine, and we sat down at Forest Hills Park in near downtown Durham, and I just dumped. I let it all... All of my secrets and all the things I was afraid of and everything that was going on, I let it out. And he told me, it was like, girl, you need to come with me. You need a new home group. We need to get you a sponsor. And so we went, he took me to the Durham Central Group, which was the oldest group in Durham at this point in time. They'd been there like 60 years now. And one of the oldest groups in North Carolina, actually. And I still had this like, how am I ever going to find a good sponsor, you know, looking for that perfect sponsor. And finally, this redneck named Jimmy Fowler, he said, boy, I tell you what, he said, I'm going to find you a sponsor for you. How about that? And I said, okay. So he introduced me to his sponsor. His name is Jesse Sell. Jesse was straight. He was Republican. He was He'd been married to one woman. It's the only person he'd ever had sex with his whole life. And he was a retired preacher. But I agreed to go to lunch with him. And we went to lunch, and I said, well, there's three things you need to know about me. I said, number one, I said, I'm HIV positive. I said, I'm gay, and I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in God. And he was like, do you want to stay sober one day at a time? And I said, yes. He says, well, then I'll work with you. And again, the hand of God, this is not what I would have chosen. Yet it is exactly what I needed. What I needed was to, for the first time, kind of get beyond the cultural things in the fellowship that had kept me sober for 7 years, and I needed to get down to the program. I needed to get down to the program that's written in that first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in another sort of brilliant higher power moment planted in my head, I said, you know what? Why don't, Jesse, you take me through the steps 1 through 12 as if I don't know anything about the program. I want to pretend I know nothing. I want to throw out everything that I think I know about this recovery, and I want to be a newcomer again. And it was the best thing I ever did. And he did, and he started me at 1, and we cracked the book, and we sat in some really cheap diners and for hours on end, and we read the book together, and we didn't stop until we got to 12. And that's when the cash and the prizes started happening. That's when my life changed, and I started praying. I didn't know who was answering, but as Jesse likes to say, he says, you know, what God is doesn't matter, Scott. He says, I don't care what you believe or what you don't believe. He says, but if you will work this program, you will know that there's a higher power out there who knows your name, and that when you reach out to that higher power, that it will answer you and it will help you. And I learned how to keep my prayers simple. I learned how to ask for help, even though I didn't know who I was asking it from, and I learned how to get out of my way. Step one is the most powerful tool we have in our toolkit of recovery is surrender. I don't ever want to forget that. No matter what problem I'm having, not just the drinking and the drugging, but all my life problems, my love problems, my money problems, my food problems, my sex problems, all of them, I need to never forget that at any moment in time, I can wave the white flag and surrender. And that's where the healing starts. And so that's the most important tool. I never want to forget that. Step two was difficult for me at first because I thought it said I had to figure out what God was. And it doesn't say that. It just says, is it possible that there's something out there that's greater than me? And frankly, for me, it was one of those things where the less I know about it or the less I think about it, the better off I am. So I eventually worked through that. I had a little epiphany recently where I was talking about this whole issue about questions and answers about what God is or what God isn't, you know, and that whole notion of a question and an answer is a fundamentally non-spiritual approach to life. Because, you know, again, for my higher power to be big enough and grand enough to solve my drinking problem, it needs to be a higher power that I can't possibly wrap my mind around. No religion, no book, no religious practice can possibly describe it sufficiently. And so the notion of figuring God out has, for me, had to be put aside. And third step, you know, that section in the Big Book where it talks about the actor and the stage, and if everyone would just do what I told them to do, wouldn't life be great? And is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness from this world if only he can manage well? I'm still hardwired to believe that if I can manage this, then I'll be okay. And I'm convinced that that is the key to my happiness, is to change you so that I can be comfortable. Another epiphany I had recently is that whole italic parts in the third step where it says, as we understood him. And I've long thought that that was a hall pass. Like, great, I don't have to figure out God right now. I don't have to understand it yet. I can just kind of keep going. And to one sense, that's true. But today, for me, and maybe this is just where I am on my journey, what I realize is those italics are an assignment. It's not a hall pass. It means I need an understanding of a power greater than myself. And the way I get that is by continuing and working the rest of the 12 steps. But that understanding isn't this thing that I figure out in order to take the journey. The understanding comes from taking the journey and then experiencing what it's like to have a higher power have influence in my life and then change and do things for me that I cannot do for myself. So the understanding comes after the fact. Fourth and the fifth step, one of my sponsees likes to say that the fourth step is where I identify all the ways that I exert power over the world in order to fix you so that I can be comfortable. And I use my anger, my fear, and my sex or relationships to do that. And the sixth step is, you know, I'm a program geek, so I love to get like into the deep study. You know, step six separates the men from the boys. That one's always been popular with me. it's just, you know, it's like that long, you know, in the big book, and so it's so easy just to kind of like just gloss through it, and yeah, let's move on and write our list, you know, and eight and Lila R. A few weeks ago, she said, you know, step six is really not all that complicated, y'all. She said, if you'll just be honest about what's working and not working in your life, you will rush headlong to step seven and ask God to remove your defects of character. Just be honest about what's not working. And I really believe that today. It's just like, if I tell the truth about my character defects, I have no choice but to want to have them removed and to be willing to have them removed. Eight and nine is where I get the promise of having not regretting the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. It's where the horrible things that I've done, the horrible things that have happened to me, become the ways that I will help a newcomer come through the door and realize that they too can stay sober. And how beautiful is that? That we're in this program where this amazing pain and suffering. Sometimes it's been done to us, and sometimes, more often, is what we've exerted to others, and that becomes the basis of which someone who walks through the room understands that they too can stay sober, and that there's no sin or shortcoming too great to be overcome in these rooms. I'm in the middle of working through my fourth run through steps four and nine with my new sponsor, Tiffany. She's a power lesbian. She's really a gay man trapped in a lesbian's body, but little tomboy. She's so cute. So, and then in 10 and 11 and 12, you know, I get to maintain my steps and practice my spiritual principles and carry the message. And there's so many ways to do that. I'm a big believer in the steps. I'm a big believer in that I have to act my way into the right way of thinking and feeling. I'm not going to figure this out. I just need to do what I'm told. And by doing what I'm told and following the program, I get to have the change happen that happens to me, and I get to, you know, eventually look back and have some understanding on that. I heard someone say recently that they were having a conversation with a newcomer, and the newcomer was saying, "Man, I'm just having such a rough time, and you know, I just don't know if I can, like, you know, I'm having such a hard time working my program." And the old timer, she said, "Well, honey, why don't you try ours?" Because, see, I mean, as an alcoholic, I'm glad someone wrote it down, you know, in the big book, you know, so that we weren't fighting over what the program was. But I really sometimes believe it really doesn't matter which program I follow, as long as I follow someone else's direction, as long as I ask for some help and I'm willing to do what you tell me to do, because that's how I get out of where my disease lives, which is up here. You know, my mind is like a bad neighborhood and I ought not go there by myself. And as Jonathan told me today, it's like, and if you do, just don't stay there long. I love that. So I started working the steps with a sponsor, and the magic happened, and I started having this spiritual awakening. I went from being this, you know, this angry, secular, you know, don't talk to me about God, to a person who realized I didn't know anything about God and that anything was possible. And the next thing you know, I'm going to church. And then the next thing you know, I'm singing in a choir. So let me warn you. And the point of that story isn't that, you know, I didn't believe in God and now I do and now I'm this happy Christian. My favorite story in the big book in the back is, it's called Flooded with Feeling, and it's very interesting because it's one of the few stories that there's no pronoun in the story that tells me, whether it's a woman or a man. I like to think of it as a man because most of the healing forces in my life are female. She says, and it's great because she talks about having this white light experience like Dr. Bob and Bill had, and those stories are just all through the big book. And she talks about having this white light experience, and she says, having had that experience, she says, I realized that, not believing in God is no barrier to having a spiritual awakening. And then she goes on and she says, but more importantly, having had that experience, I know no more about God today than I did before. And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the freedom to believe or to doubt whatever I need to in order to stay sober. And I love that. And one of the things I really cherish about my program today is my spiritual self is evolving and changing. What I believe today is not what I believed 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I go to church because I like church, but I like it because it's a cultural thing. I like to sing in the choir. It's a very beautiful church, and I enjoy doing it, but I have no illusions about that being where I find my higher power. I find my higher power in the same seats that you're sitting in right now. Spirituality to me is an undeniable part of being human. I think it's something that connects all of us together. And then religion to me is all the different ways that humans have created these human institutions to somehow describe that or appreciate it. But they're, at the end of the day, imperfect and cannot even come close to describing how wonderful God is, in my opinion. So there I am. I'm in this relationship. It's falling. I'm miserable. And this friend of mine in recovery that I finally shared this story with about this crazy man I was with, he said, Scott, you got to believe that God's more powerful than he is. And that was, I went home to him that night and I said, if we have to stay together the rest of our lives because something horrible is going to happen to me if we don't, fine. But I'm not going to pretend that I love you because I don't. And at that point, he realized that he no longer had any power over me. And I was free. And about 3 months later than that, he was gone, and I've not seen him since, and that's fine. It was bad. It was bad. He was a very, very sick man. He was also a very brilliant and smart man. And his brilliance masked how sick he was. And it just took me 10 years to find out. About 2 years later, I'm dating. I'm sober, I've worked the 12 steps, I'm getting the cash and prizes, things are going well. I walk into this gay business networking place. It was like either grow your business or find a husband. And I had, at this point, having like supported this psychopath for 9 years, not a very big salary, someone just out of school. I had, two qualifications for dating you. You had to have an XY chromosome and you had to have a job. And that was it. And so I walk in and I walk into this room. It's got about as many people as are here. I see David. We call him Nugget. That's his nickname. And I see him and he's the shortest person in the room. And that somehow stood out. He was just like this beacon there, and I walked right over to him and said hello, and we exchanged numbers, and we went on a date, and I've been dating a lot at this point, and I've just gotten to the point where I understood, like, dating can be this fun thing that I do just for the sake of dating, like, with no, like, get out of the, don't start answering questions about, China patterns and shit like that, just, did I enjoy myself, and would I like to do it again, and, like, stop there with the discussions about the dating. So we went on a date. And I'd also gotten very practiced about how to disclose, the sort of the more unique aspects of my life with my dating partners. And we're sitting there having dinner, and I was like, "Well, there's three things you need to know about me. It's always three things with me." I said, "I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm HIV positive. I'm a Christian." Because at that point, I'd started going to church, and I identified as a Christian, and that was like a whole nother fucking coming out because. Because you gay people get all worked up about Christianity, I know that there's some days when I'm in the church just to keep them from being so damn crazy towards us. You know, it's like, think of me as a spy kind of inside, you know. And I'm completely out, and it's a college university chapel that I sing in, so I really love being there as this, you know, almost 50-year-old gay man who's like super out and successful, and these kids come into this environment, you know, with all the bullshit that their parents teach them about being queer, and half of them that come to a church choir are queer. That's just... that's been happening like that since they first invented religion. And I want to be there for them, you know. I want to show them that, you know, that these things are not mutually exclusive. That's really important to me. So anyway, so I tell Nugget these three things, you know, HIV positive, recovering alcoholic, and I'm a Christian, and doesn't miss a beat. We finish our dinner. I take him for a little walk over to a little gazebo on campus where usually I was able to get a little sucky face, you know, before, but he was not having any of it that night. So he goes back to his parents, calls his dad that night. I hear about this much later, of course, and calls his dad. He's like, "Dad," it's like, "Oh man, I met this guy and I really like him, but listen to this, you know, da 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 da." And his dad says, "Well, son, I mean, you got to watch out for those Christians." So this coming June, we'll celebrate 15 years together. Many of y'all have gotten to meet Nugget this weekend. He loves his drunks. He loves his drunks. And in fact, he loves his drunks so much, he started going to Al-Anon. I think it's okay for me to share that, isn't it, honey? Yeah, all right. You know, I want, early in my recovery, I remember hearing a guy talk one day at a meeting, and he said, "Make no bones about it, my goal is to stay sober the rest of my life." And that really got my attention, because everything that I'd been hearing up to that point is about one day at a time. And he said, "How I'm going to stay sober the rest of my life is one day at a time." I really relate to this. It's vitally important to me to die sober. I remember when I came into the rooms in 1987, probably half the men that were in those rooms in Houston, Texas are no longer alive. And I remember, like most people who come into the rooms, I remember, you know, I'm full of these reservations I have about my sobriety. It's like, well, okay, I'm going to try this, you know, so far so good, and I'm going to try this, but you know, there's a list of some things that, you know, I'm going to reserve the right to go back and drink if, you know, this. Just, I wouldn't tell anybody about them, just had them in my back pocket, going to pull them out if I needed them, you know? Just a little escape plan in case y'all turned out to be, you know, a cult or something like that, and I needed to be extricated. But I watched these men face their mortality, face the thing that I was most afraid of. To this day, the thing that I fear most is death. And it's not because, well, it's mainly because I enjoy life so much. I just don't want this to end. And the idea that one day it will end is frightening. And I know that that's just part of what makes me human. But I watched these men face their mortality with the dignity and staying sober and die without taking a drink or a drug. And those men saved my life, because they took away any reason that I had, any excuse that I might ever have to put a bottle to my lips and take a drink. I think I'll close with this. About 4 months after I took my mom in for that MRI, she had been in a nursing home for one night. And I got a call from the attendants, and they told me that they were taking her to the emergency room. She'd evidently asphyxiated, or I forget the right word, but you know, she'd aspirated, and she was unconscious when she got in. Going into the emergency room in the OR, and the nurses and the doctors are ripping this, you know, big pipes and tubes and, you know, cutting her gown, and this drama, and 2 days previous when she was checked out of the hospital. She'd had a stroke about 3 months previous to that and had very limited speech problems. But I remember sitting down with her and the doctor said, you know, talking to her with about a DNR, a do not resuscitate. And my mom had a very difficult time communicating at this point, but I remember her telling me, you know, it's like, Mom, if something happens, you know, what? And she was like, you let me go. She said, let me go. It was very clear to me and her doctor about what her desire was. And 2 nights later, I was in the emergency room and they're getting ready to do all these horrible things to her. And I had to scream at the top of my lungs to these 12 people that she had a DNR, she had a DNR. And they kind of turn and look at me and then they started ruffling through the papers and they realize, and this is the hardest thing I've ever had to do, was to stand there and be there for her when she couldn't be there for herself. And she died that night. And I was there, and I was sober, and I was with her. And I remember about 2 weeks later in my home group sharing about it as I was experiencing a pain, the depths of which I've never experienced before or after. And I remember this combination of pain that I just did not think I could get through, but this also profound gratitude that I was able to feel it, that I was able to be present with this moment, that it was such an honor to hurt and to miss her and to want her back. And that is such a sober thing, you know, to be hurting so bad that I would almost do anything to stop feeling it, and yet to feel like it was a privilege to be feeling it. And that's what I get in this program. Lila R. said, you know, God lives not in the valleys and not on the mountaintops, but in the spaces in the middle where we match calamity with serenity. God isn't in the peaks and not in the depths. It's where life, which is going to come at us, and it's going to be hard, but where we meet it with serenity and we meet it with the tools that we need in order to live spiritually, and most importantly, to not drink. That's where I find my higher power. I find her or him in these rooms with people like you, and I'm so grateful that y'all invited me to come speak tonight. Thank you.